Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering.
There's pass deflected, stolen. Grant Williams will dribble it out. And the Boston Celtics finally able to turn out the lights on Atlanta.
That's the sound of the Boston Celtics beating the Atlanta Hawks last night to move on to the next round of the NBA playoffs. The Celtics are arguably the most popular team in town right now, led by stars Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. They're also a team of primarily black men who have spoken out at times about the experience of being black in Boston. But many of the people who watch and cover Boston sports are white. And some recent comments by local sports media have revived old questions about Boston's perception as a racist city. Does Boston still deserve that reputation? Well, to answer that or to talk about that, we're joined in studio by Shalice Manza-Young. She's a columnist with Yahoo Sports and previously covered the New England Patriots for the Providence Journal and the Boston Globe. Hi, Shalice.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Dart Adams, a journalist, historian, host of Dart Against Humanity and Boston Legends podcast. Hi, Dart.
Hi, good morning.
And we are joined by Radio Boston producer Kyrie Thompson, who also formerly covered Boston sports for Boston.com and WEEI. Kyrie, welcome to this side of the studio.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Okay, I'm going to start out with a question for all of you. Black Americans make up just 6% of all journalists and only 5% of sports journalists, so even less, according to the Pew Research Center. How have you seen that in your experiences covering Boston and the city's sports team? Shalice, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I'm part of an even smaller percentage, which is black women in sports media. So it's, from my perspective and, you know, the bulk of my career, or what I'm most known for, is for covering the Patriots, which also is a majority black team, I never had issues with the players. And in fact, you know, the black men who are agents, NFL agents, the black men who are scouts and assistant coaches, and the other black men in, you know, the NFL media sphere, we all, they, you know, the agents and scouts looked out for me. The other reporters, you know, sort of took me in as a little sister. And the players I was fine with. It was the readers and the audience who, you know, how much of it was gendered and how much of it was racial, it's hard to separate. A lot of them, the negative feedback I got was almost always, what do you know? You're only a woman. You've never played football before. Sometimes there was, you're nothing but an affirmative action hire or a quota hire, which is ridiculous. You know, as Jemele Hill has said, if there were a quota, there'd be more of me. There'd be more women that look like me when I walk into locker rooms and press boxes and things like that. So it's the issue I got most often was with the audience. And I think that sort of underscores what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Dart, I want to turn to you next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how have you seen, you know, the lack of representation in sports journalism? You know, how has that affected you?
Pretty much I have to always set the record straight and give context and explain things that normally I wouldn't have to, because, again, you have to consider the audience. You have to consider who you're covering, right? If you don't understand certain context or certain things about how this is going, how this looks, when you refer to a player after this time or this event happens, like, you don't understand what you're doing or what you're saying, but we all receive it. And that's the reason why a lot of folks cannot listen to Boston Sports Radio. We can't go on Boston Sports Reddits. We can't open blindly and just openly accept anybody who's also a Celtics fan on Twitter. We're going to have to open up your page and go through your entire timeline for coded language, RTs of people that we don't agree with, you know, like, so that's the issue too. And then also, like, in covering the, do you guys know what it looks like to have a bunch of white guys talking about something and we're sitting there watching, like, they don't get it. They don't get it. So it's always that issue. You know, we always have to go uphill.
I mean, and is there a sense, too, of like having to interpret the context for your superiors or for your editors? Is that something you've dealt with?
Well, in any space I've been in, whether we're talking about sports, media, film publishing, it's always me trying to explain to a white executive why this has value or what this is. So it's frustrating, endlessly frustrating.
Yeah. Right. Kyrie, yeah, you jump in.
Yeah, I'm over here just you know, preach. But I think one example of that I encountered was, you know, working on, I was pitched a story about what a local doctor said about LeBron James. And, you know, LeBron James, you should be advocating for the COVID vaccine, you know, because, you know, you're a popular black athlete, you're visible. If you do it, more black people will get vaccinated. And normally when you get a story like that, they kind of want you to just write 300, 400 words about it and then call it a day. And I remember getting that and being like, I can't do that in 300, 400 words. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, first of all, I'm a former scientist, so I had to take some time and really, really think about this. And so I had to just be like, you know, to my editor, look, I can't just do this today. I need to take the time. And to give him credit, he gave me space to do that. He let me take a couple of weeks and build it out and talk about the hesitance about surrounding the black community and vaccines and get a doctor on the story to talk about it and the work that they've done in terms of outreach. And I feel like so often that can be the case where our stories are kind of like, oh, well, you know, this person said something. Why don't you go ahead and write a blurb on it? You can't just write a blurb on some of this stuff. You got to give the story the justice that it deserves. And so often it feels like that isn't taken into account.
No, there's no context and nuance provided, and they don't even understand that it's needed in
right.
a lot of cases.
Shalice, yeah.
You had asked, you know, Dart about how does that come across or the lack of representation in media locally. The event that I keep going back to is in 2017 when Adam Jones, mm-hmm. who was then playing for the Baltimore Orioles, told reporters after a game at Fenway Park that he had been called the N-word multiple times and had peanuts thrown at him. Any black person heard him say that and said, yep. But of course, because at the time there was only one black person on either of the two, one total black person right. on the Boston Sports Radio, the two
Hawley,
stations, it was Michael Hawley. And this actually ended up, he told me recently, this event ended up being the beginning of the end for
yes.
him at WEEI. The initial response the next morning, or all of the response, was indignation mm-hmm. that how dare Adam Jones say what he said, including from an NFL reporter who I thought I was friendly with at the time.
Oh, I know what you mean.
On Twitter, talking about, I've been to Fenway 200 times. I reached out to that person privately and explained to him racism that I have dealt with, my husband has dealt with, my family has dealt with as Massachusetts, greater Boston, in Boston, and he just pushed back entirely. And I shut that person out of my life. And that is where it comes out. The news cycle should have been, hey, you are all making us look bad. All of the white hosts on the sports radio stations should have said, this is why Boston has this reputation. Mm-hmm. Because a couple of you show your ugly butts and it makes the rest of us look bad. But the news cycle was the outrage at the black man who had absolutely nothing to gain and everything to lose by telling the world what happened to him.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so along similar lines, Shalice, the next question, you covered the Patriots for a long time here, and you wrote a column about the underlying culture and history of racism in Boston sports here. So can you talk a little bit more about what motivated you to speak up on this?
Well, what motivated me is, you know, what happened at both sports radio stations. Within the 2023 calendar year, we saw at WEEI, there was a producer who jumped in and mentioned Mina Kimes, who was an Asian American woman, and then after the fact tried to cover up his racism by saying he meant sexism instead.
Mm-hmm. So much better.
So much better. And then within, I think just 5 weeks before, somebody at 98.5 just blithely made a joke. I'll try to condense the story, but his co-host was somewhere else and was broadcasting remotely. There were two black men that you could see in the room with him. They were sitting there minding their business. And Tony Maserati on 98.5 says, hey, can those guys hear us? And Michael Felger says, no, they can't. He says, hey, be careful. The last time you were in a room with guys like that, they stole your car. Now, Michael Felger was in New Orleans. The last previous time he was in New Orleans, he dropped his daughter, who apparently is a college student down there. He dropped her off at a nightclub, got out of the rental, got out of his car, left the keys in the car, and had the car stolen. Was it stolen by those two black men in the room with him? Absolutely not. But yet, that's the leap that Tony Maserati, the joke that Tony Maserati made. Mm-hmm. And so those things, just instead of me reacting, I took a deeper dive. And Michael Hawley was kind enough to, you know, share with me his experiences of being at WEEI for over a decade. And I know Kyrie has experience there as well. That is the voice of the city in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is the voice that is speaking. Even take the black Bostonians out of it. They're not really talking to us.
No, that's why they don't listen.
Right. But how many white Bostonians are comfortable with that being, this is some of the highest rated programming in the country,
mm-hmm.
not just in this city.
Right.
It's some of the highest rated radio programming in the country. And you allow that to be the voice of the city?
And that's why we haven't listened for over 20 years.
Right. Yeah. Dart, I've been watching you nod in agreement over here. You know, as someone who is deeply embedded in Boston, what went through your mind when you read what Shalice had to say?
I wasn't surprised, and I'm glad it was written, and I'm glad it was condensed in a form where people can actually take it all in, because if you tell somebody these things happened, they try to shrug it off and act like it didn't happen. But if you take it and you present it in, you know, the form that she did, you can't deny it anymore. And our experiences, our lives, basically in Boston, you either get overwritten or you get erased, right? So our experiences are constantly being like tossed aside. And when we explain to you that as sports fans, we can't do what you do. I can't just go to the greatest sports bar. You know, I have to make sure that it's a safe space for my people before I go there. You know, so I get asked all the time, it's like, where do y'all go to watch Celtics games? I watch Celtics games at home. It's like, so do you go to a lot of games? Typically, no, you know, right. But like, I'd love to go, but it's just like, there's so many other things in place. As a black fan, you have to protect yourself, you know, and you have to also consider what you're doing and who you're allowing into your space at every turn. And that's not something the typical Boston sports fan even has to think about.
All right. So we are talking with Shalice Manza-Young, Boston journalist, also historian Dart Adams, and Radio Boston producer Kyrie Thompson. We're discussing race in Boston, race in Boston sports. Let's see. I want to talk about, like, the experience of racism in Boston impacts, it seems like, most any athlete here who is a person of color, even Bill Russell, who won 11 NBA championships with the Celtics as a player and a coach. Famously experienced racism in Boston. He even famously called the city a, quote, flea market of racism.
One of the wildest quotes I've ever heard.
Dart, the next question, like, what does it mean to you that arguably the most impactful Boston athlete ever has had those kinds of struggles here?
Well, for one thing that we need to put into context, Bill Russell was the first black athlete that was the face of a franchise almost in basketball, period. Not only was he the face of the franchise in Boston in the 60s, he was the head coach, and he was replacing a beloved player in Bob Cousy, and he was doing it in Boston in the 60s at a time when the NBA wasn't even a super popular sport, when the Boston Garden could be anywhere between 60 to 65% capacity because the Bruins were bigger and people were going to see the Red Sox instead. So that's another thing. And also the racism he experienced in Boston, a lot of times when he talks about it, it was happening when he moved into Reading, Mass. Now, what they never talk about is the times that he experienced in Roxbury, Southend, Dorchester, how he was a part of that community with the other black Celtics, you know, Satch Sanders, Sam Jones, you know, all the other guys. That's never spoken about. Mm-hmm. But when Bill Russell talks about the racism in Boston, he talks about the media. You know, he talks about the institutional racism. And it hasn't changed as much as we like to think it has. Because when you look at the way the Celtics are covered, if the Celtics lose, everybody loves and respects and trusts Marcus Smart. But if Marcus Smart is the reason for a turnover late in the game so they don't close out game five, all of a sudden everybody wants to throw him out with the bathwater and the bassinet and the baby. You know? So these are the issues that we often have to deal with as Boston fans, and we always track it. We always track it. It's like you love Jason Tatum today, but Thursday, you might hate his guts if he goes 1-for-11 from three. And now he's the worst person on the planet. And we see it all, and we know why it is. I'm sure she could tell you, when we would grow up, just the Celtics lost the game, you would pick up the Boston Herald sometimes and see what player was on the front of the sports page.
Right.
If the Celtics won, you might see Larry Bird, you might see Kevin McHale, you might see Danny Ainge. If the Celtics lost, it might be a big picture of DJ, you know? And right. So we used to, and it's like, and the thing was that we just thought we knew that in the city. The players caught wind of it too. So if you come from another state or another city and you get drafted to Boston and you spend your career here, you're always looking for these type of things, right? That imbalance in coverage. Like Brian Scalabrine, beloved guy. He's like,
didn't
Bryant's,
do anything.
Nothing.
As Bryant's, a player.
Brian Scalabrine is the voice of the Boston Celtics. And I could tell you, Kyle Draper should have had that job. And I remember an incident where Kyle Draper was getting cut off, and he just got pissed off to the point he was like, oh, so I can't talk? I can't talk? I was like, Kyle won't be back next year. Right.
And then, you know, there you go.
Kyrie.
And you know what that reminds me of is reading up on the Boston Red Sox. And, you know, there was a symposium like a couple of years ago when I was at Boston.com. I covered this where it was Jim Rice, Ellis Burks, and Mo Vaughn all talking about the experience of being black baseball players in this city. And I remember doing some research on that, and Ellis Burks recalls apparently Jim Rice telling him, look, when you do get your 6 years done in this city and get out. And that stuck with me big time because it's not just about, for example, I'm a transplant, right? So I'm from the Chicagoland area. So I didn't grow up here. I came here and you hear the stories, but like largely my experience has not reflected what the stories are. But every once in a while, something will happen where it is part of that. And for example, just the other day, I had somebody tell me on Twitter, you know, you've never really fit into the Boston sports scene here. And to me, the moment he said, I knew exactly mm-hmm. what he meant, because it had nothing to do with, you know, my sports opinions or anything like that. It had everything to do with who I was mm-hmm. and what I represent in this space, which is that when you go to Gillette Stadium mm-hmm. or you go to the Boston Red Sox press box, mm-hmm. you look around and there might be two other people that look like you there.
Out of 100.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left in the segment, and so I want to take a couple minutes. Shalise, the last question's for you. Is there anywhere where strides are being made in sports coverage or even representation in Boston sports media?
Oh, goodness. you know, it's hard for me to say yes. I'm a little more detached from it. I don't go to the press boxes as much anymore as I used to. It seems like if there is any diversity in sports media, it's with the Boston Globe. The Boston Herald, no. To this day, I believe, has only had one black writer, and that was Howard Bryant, as far as I know. And Howard's been gone from there for over a decade.
Yes, he has.
I
mean, if you look at, like, the local station, you know, you have a few black folks, you know, behind the desk, you know, doing commentary. You bring in former Celtics there. You have Amina Smith, you know, over there now, but she's on maternity leave, I believe. And like, but we still look at Brian Scalabrine, you know? So it's like, that's the same, that's the issue. It's like, there'll be some things here, but they're almost cosmetic, because when you look at the head of the table, who's doing the big job?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who you don't want doing the big job.
Well,
you know?
That's a huge part of it as well. I think if we look behind the scenes and who is doing the hiring,
yes,
it's all. It's. I know that remains that way at the Globe. I know it's that way at the Herald.
Right.
You know, my career was primarily in print. The only reason I was on TV here in Boston was a man named Larry Lawson, who I believe now is at WBZ, was in charge of talent at NESN, and he had me on NESN all the time when I was covering the Patriots. But it took a black man to hire me and say, let's get you on camera. I see you. I believe in you. I know you know what you're doing. Let's put you on camera.
The only advances really are in new media.
Right.
You know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube.
But legacy media.
Yeah, but not legacy media.
I wish we could keep talking about this. We are out of time. I want to thank our guests for being here. Shalice Manza-Young, Yahoo Sports columnist and Boston sports media veteran. Boston journalist and historian Dart Adams and Radio Boston producer and former Boston sports reporter Kyrie Thompson. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.